Hurry! And aside from the news, which was mentioned at the AGM, but I don't think has been well disseminated, that all members get a $300 credit to their consumption bills next June. Present from the treasurer. We were going to have a pretty good list of speakers. Ending at the top of the list, we'll start at the bottom, really. Hong Kong's Defenders in Prison, 1942 to 45. It's a book launch by Tony Bannum, a topic of perennial interest. Another lunch, Paul French, Through the Looking Glass, China's Foreign Journalists from Opium Wars to Mao. This is going to be a little interesting, but certainly a topic close to the Foreign Correspondents Club. Those are minor. We've got two, which I can't say are firmly announced, but we are already discussing topic with Donald Tsang. We haven't got the date right, but it seems to me it could be June 15. Don't tell anyone. Jimmy Lai, later in the month, who hasn't confirmed because it's very difficult to pin down. Beijing has been trying to pin him down for the last 15 years and not succeeded. But he's going to be very interesting, and he's going to just simply make it a conversation with Jimmy Lai, which I think all of us could find very entertaining. Then, coming up in June 1, the Cardinal will speak to us at last. He's already given us his speech topic, Contra Spem in Spem Creditit. Those of you who speak Latin will understand this entirely. But I am assured that he will not speak in Latin. A topic taken from the book of Romans, though there seemed no hope, in hope he believed, meaning that he is still confident of the eventual victory of democracy in China. I'm sure he's going to be very worthwhile, of course, and we've been trying for some time to get the Cardinal to come. And one that is now already fully booked and was booked in practically minutes. You had to be fast when that came out on the list. Bao Pu, editor of Prisoner of State, Memoirs of Zhao Ziyang, on June the 4th, an appropriate date if there ever was one. That one is unfortunately fully booked, but you might want to put your name on a waiting list in case anyone cancels that waiting list. Will be going. We'll have the place packed for that one. And I particularly want to mention it because it's appropriate to today's topic, translating Chinese literature. Martin and I have been table mates at the club table for many years, long lunches there, in part allowed because I gave Martin, his partner in the footwear industry, good advice 6 years ago and said, yeah, buy your property, go ahead. The financial relief has allowed him to spend longer lunches than he otherwise would. Sitting there is quite often. I'll be looking up the TV above, and something's happening on Phoenix TV on the news, and Marty's just translating as smoothly as could be. And this has always interested me. The art of the translator as someone who doesn't only bring along the anomalies of literature, of language, but anomalies of culture, which is, I think, in part what we'll be hearing from him about today, on a translation of the book English, for the original author, Wang Gang. It's a title that one has to be a bit careful with. I recall the great publication in the 1920s of a book in Pakistan, textbook, English as She Is Spoke. This will not be the case with Marty's. We're looking at a good translation from someone who's put a great deal of work into becoming a professional translator over recent years. And he will now tell us a little bit about his art.
Thanks, Jake. In my 20 years of FCC membership, I've often thought, while attending lunches like this, you'll find me behind the microphone when pigs fly. And now, swine flu. Thank you. Before I proceed any further, let me just make a quick survey. Who can name more than 5 Chinese classics? Yes. How many have you read? Yes. Who has a green hat? Who can name more than 5 modern Chinese fiction classics? Oh, one. Good. How many have you read? Who has worn a green hat? What's the humour of the pig's fly swine flu joke evaporates when it needs explaining. What do we do when we try to convey something like that in the other direction? Early in this novel, the green roof of a school building sets the scene for a great deal of green hat wearing. But how to explain that it means the husband of an adulteress, often regarded as an object of derision, from the cuckoo's habit of laying eggs in another bird's nest, the cuckold, without disrupting the flow of the translation. There are lots of things that are unfamiliar and frankly a little strange to the English reader that are commonplace in Chinese. What about explaining the great proletarian culture revolution? How much can we assume the average reader knows about recent Chinese history? How much explaining should we, as translators, do? These questions are what academics in translation studies call the cultural issues. My favourite cultural issue is swearing. Off-colour language is always fun to learn, and indeed, the main character of this novel, Love Liu, trawled the dictionary for dirty words just like any high school boy anywhere in the world. We have the F word in English, or heaven forbid the C word. The Chinese have the 3-character classic. That's a euphemism for foul language based on a children's text constructed entirely of rhyming 3-character lines. There's a new one coming along, the grass mud horse. How many know about the grass mud horse? Wow, okay. Okay, now the main character in this book is called Love Liu. By the time I was 12, which is his age, I might have let fly with the occasional shit when my mother wasn't around. But I was acutely aware that even an ill-timed bloody would get me in big trouble. The next section I'm going to have to skip because I just can't do it. I'm sorry, but it's... I will pass around a sheet, if you like, a page from the Cantonese Dictionary of Slang that is probably just to prove that Cantonese wins hands down when it comes to swearing. When we did this at the Shanghai Literary Festival, my co-translator, Jane, managed to say it while looking at the author. So she found inspiration there. But here it is. I'll pass it around and you can just... bottom left. Now back to the book. One of the charming aspects of this book is the schoolboy shenanigans, which reminded me so much of my own childhood. There's a scene where the main character, Love Liu, gets his revenge on his classmate, Garbage Lee, by kicking him in the bum as hard as he can. Lee's response in Chinese slides smoothly off the tongue. Niabi, ayo! And I couldn't stop saying it, I was just giggling. But to get it across into English without being jarring is just not possible. So eventually we settled on something like, son of a bitch, ow. Okay. On another occasion, Love Liu is reciting English in class, but his classmates are laughing at his accent. He is livid and bellows at them, "Xiao ni ma bina." Oh, gee. He's taken the 3-character classic and creatively modified it for the circumstances. A literal translation would definitely interrupt the flow of the narrative because "I laugh at your mother's cunt" is really jarring, to say the least. We ended up with going for, "You motherfuckers, what's so funny?" It's not entirely satisfactory, but in the context, a reference to a mother was required. Now, there are the names of the key characters in the book we chose to actually translate rather than transliterate. And Chinese personal names can sometimes be very difficult to deal with. There are unusual groupings of Q's, Z's, X's and J's that look quite outlandish if you don't know how pinyin works. Another reason that we translated the names is that they conveyed something important about each character. Love, Liu, the teacher, second prize Wang, which it turns out was the true name of the author's primary school English teacher. Sunrise Huang, one of his classmates, who is also based on a real person, and Garbage Li. These are just wonderful names. But names with meanings can be dangerous. English teachers are often requested to give names to their students. A former English teacher, who is unfortunately not in the room with us today, but we all know, was bewildered when a student burst into tears after he named her Paula. Unfortunately, Paula sounds exactly like Paula, or broken, as in broken hymen. That got a better laugh in Shanghai. Now, another problem with translating literature is that sometimes you just hit a roadblock and you can't figure out how to explain something without a footnote. But who wants to refer to footnotes or endnotes when reading a novel? So there are other strategies that we use. There's an example that I'd like to use was referring to a person called Zhang Zhixin. And okay, hands up, who knows Zhang Zhixin? Right, gotcha. Okay. So I'll read a straight translation of what the passage would sound like. After I grew up, I heard the story of Zhang Zhixin and read poems that paid tribute to her and thought the poets were making a fuss about nothing. Didn't they know? That's just the way women are. But who is Zhang Zhixin? If I don't provide something, an explanation, a footnote, a hint, anything is better than nothing. Without prior knowledge, readers of translations will not get the underlying message. This is what we ended up doing. After I grew up, I heard the story of Zhang Zhixin. She was a Communist Party member who refused to change her critical views on the idealization of Chairman Mao and the party's ultra-left policies, even after being jailed and tortured. To prevent her from shouting slogans on the way to the execution ground, her jailers cut her vocal cords. I later read poems that paid tribute to her and thought the poets were making a fuss about nothing. Didn't they know? That's just the way women are. The Chinese translator of The Kite Runner of Kabul decided that he did not want to burden his readers with too much cultural baggage. So he chose to translate salam as ni hao or hello. Now that's a valid choice, but it's not the one that I would make. In a recent New York Times review of translations, Jess Russ suggests that some cultural references are untranslatable. It's an unending debate. Now the title of the book, English, in Chinese is Inglish. So it's about learning English. In the book, there are many examples of Love Liu and his classmates rote learning English by chanting after their teacher. One of the phrases they learn is long live Chairman Mao, for obvious reasons. It's set during the Cultural Revolution. Love Liu frequently refers to using characters as a phonetic crutch. For Chinese speakers, there is a long tradition of finding Chinese words that approximate the sound of English. You can still buy almanacs in Hong Kong that give the pronunciation in Cantonese of useful words. My favourite Cantonese commercial English, which comes from a recently published almanac. On page... Oh, they don't number the pages. Okay. So, do you want to try it? She's shy. Come on. I wanted Rebo to come up to give it authenticity. So.
What do 要王悲托。Sorry, 屈都要，对不起啊，是屈都要王托悲字啊。
What do you want to buy? Okay. The answer to the question, how's business?
富罗里城
flourishing. The problems arise in this system when syllables don't fit. Cantonese needs three syllables.
Bei-si-tu.
For the word best. And you did your best job. Thank you. okay. In the 1950s, the Korean War required that young soldiers who might come in contact with Americans could say, Hansa Apu. Hands up? Here, I'll pass it around. Okay. So Love Leo and his classmates were following a long tradition when they used Chinese words as phonetic crutches. Now, back to Long Live Chairman Mao.The Chinese words that Love Liu used to assist him remembering the sounds of English were Lang Li Wu Qian Men Mao. Now, there's three ways to translate that. Could transliterate it into pinyin, which would be Lang Li Wu Qian Men Mao. Doesn't convey anything. Or we could translate it literally, Wolf stands in the room, front door hairy. Not so good.Or find an English approximation of what the utterance would sound like. And I thought of Long Leave You, Cha Moon Mao. But when you're co-translating a book and you've got an editor in New York, sometimes you have to negotiate. I favoured number three, Long Leave You, Cha Moon Mao, while Jane preferred a combination of one or two, one and two, and so did the editor.So the result was Lonely Wolf, Chaiman Mao. I'll see you after class. Wang Gang, the author, grew up in Xinjiang before moving back to Peking, where he was a successful businessman and scriptwriter. In the 1990s, he made a journey back to his hometown and began to reminisce about his childhood. The result is English.A semi-autobiographical novel published in 2004. It was voted the best novel of the year and winner of the prestigious literary prizes in China and Taiwan. And in fact, the version you see up here is the Taiwan edition. The book has been translated into French and Italian. Set in the late 1960s, early 1970s, it's about growing up in Xinjiang, at that time an extremely remote part of China,where the Chinese were in a very small minority. In the introduction to the Taiwan version, Wang Gang explained a bit more about how this book came about. Violence dominated my childhood. I watched adults fight. At times, their creativity for violence went to extremes.I watched as some burly red guards killed a female teacher and then paraded her body around the school grounds. The same way we children of Urumqi pulled a sled over the fields of snow. It was very sunny that day as they subjected the dead woman to further indignity of exposing her drained, anemic face to the bright sunlight. Finally, they tossed her onto a pile of rubbish next to the latrines,forbidding anyone to collect her corpse. That once elegant-looking teacher eventually emitted a stench that stank to high heaven, even on a freezing winter's day. So nowadays, whenever someone waxes nostalgic for the Red Guards, I recall what they looked like when they killed people. Any questions?Well, I have got a little excerpt that I can play for you. Let's see. Now, while you're listening to this excerpt, look at this picture. Most Chinese novels are published in small literary magazines that are illustrated. And the same was the case with English. This was published in Dang Dai in 2003. And there were 6 illustrations in the novel. And I think they're delightful. And they really assist the story. But the editors at Penguin said, illustrations are for children's books. So I'll just give you a minute of Wang Gang's voice because it's actually a 10-minute excerpt. But I thought it would be interesting just for you to hear what it sounds like when he reads it.
English. 第一章, 第三节. 博格达峰就在我的前方, 那儿是乌鲁木齐河的发源地。 在清冷的五月, 我走在泥泞里, 阳光灿烂, 我手里提着饭盒, 显得亮晶晶的。 我是去给父亲送饭的, 他早晨说中午就不回来了, 他要尽快把那幅画画完。 剧场的对面搭起了一面墙, 爸爸站在脚手架上, 他刚画完了一个人的头像, 现在正在画他的肩膀。 在我们所有人都很瘦的时候, 那个人却很胖, 他就是毛主席。 我走到跟前说, 爸爸,吃饭了。 爸爸没有理我, 他仍在聚精会神地画着。 我说,爸爸吃饭。 他没有回头, 说,像吗? 我看了看, 说,好像是少了一只耳朵。 父亲说,你懂什么? 那叫透视规律。 我说,就是少了一只耳朵。 父亲有些生气了。 他停止了画画, 把眼镜正了正, 从脚手架上往下爬。 他的姿态灵活, 像是西公园的猴子, 攀附在钢管和木板之间, 晃悠了几下之后, 他跳了下来。 我看了看他额头上的汗, 就说, 画画很累, 是吗? 他说, 那要看画什么了。 我说,你看,是不是少了一只耳朵? 爸爸说,以后要有可能,你也要当建筑师。 画画的基础,说着,他拿起了一块包谷饼,吃了一大口, 可是他不小心却咬了自己的手指, 疼得他看自己的手,没有破,只是咬出了牙印儿。 他笑了,说饿了,又有好几天,春节过后,
Okay, I'll interrupt it there because it goes for a full 10 minutes. And if Mr. Van de Kamp will allow me, I'll just read that section out in English. So this is the illustration that accompanies this section. One sunny day, that crisp cold May, I walked along a muddy road, lunchbox in hand, to take food to my father. That morning, he'd mentioned he wouldn't be home for lunch because he had to finish a painting. A wall had been put up right in front of the theatre. Father was standing on the scaffolding. He had just finished painting someone's head and was now painting the shoulders. Everyone was skinny in those days, except this guy. It was Chairman Mao. I walked up and said, Dad, time for lunch. He ignored me, focusing on the portrait. Dad, lunch, I persisted. Without turning around, he asked, Does it look like him? I glanced at the painting. One ear is missing, I commented. What do you know, Father snapped. This is according to the laws of perspective. One ear is missing, I insisted. Father became annoyed and stopped painting. He adjusted his glasses and started to climb down from the scaffolding, as nimbly as a monkey in West Zoo. After a few swings between the steel pipes and the wooden boards, he jumped to the ground. I saw sweat on his forehead. Painting is hard work, right? That depends on the subject, he replied. Look, I said, can't you tell an ear is missing? If you have the chance, you should also become an architect when you grow up. The basics of drawing. As he spoke, he took a huge bite out of a maize cake and bit down on his finger. He checked his finger and saw only teeth marks. The skin wasn't broken. He grinned. I'm just a glutton, he said. It's been a while now. I haven't eaten meat since the spring festival. The taste of pig's feet is a distant memory for me. So, any questions?
Hi, Martin. I'll wait for you to sit down. I'm sure you're familiar with the hardcover box sets of the classics such as The Journey to the West and Dream of the Red Mansions and Outlaws of the Marsh, and they're all very nice, and they have a little ribbon in each book so you can mark your place. And they're all published by the Foreign Language Press, and the translators, the name Sidney Shapiro sticks in my mind for some reason. But they all read very, very simplistically. They don't read as what I would consider literature. Is that the translation? Is there better translations, or is that the nature of the work?
Yeah, you're quite right. Those foreign literature ones published in China are a little bit stiff. And Sidney Shapiro, although he made a valiant effort, started his career, I think, as a taxi driver. There is a shortage of good translations of the classics. My translation mentor is John Minford, who translated Honglomong as The Story of the Stone, and it's out in Penguin Classics, 5 volumes, 2,500 pages. And I think if you read that, you will come away very, very happy. But he said a new translation is needed every generation. So that's a real problem. There aren't very many translations of the Chinese classics, and some of them are quite awful.
Hi, Marty. I'm curious, seeing as active as Wang Gang is, did you ever encounter text that you were tempted, you and Jane, to contact him for collaboration? And no doubt different authors have a different involvement in translation. How involved were you with him during the process?
Well, we waited until we'd finished the first draft, and then we came up with a list of 20 queries and telephoned him, and he sorted us out very quickly. We didn't actually have much contact with him because sometimes authors who don't speak the translated language want to get involved in the translation, and that can be unpleasant. So, but now we're good friends. Wang Gang actually made that little video last night in Peking, and Mitch Farkas FTP'd it up to me this morning. So we're on very good terms.
Francis Moriarty. Marty, when you listen to a writer speak, we hear his writing as he heard it in his head, as he wrote it. And so the question of rhythm and breath is involved. When you're translating, how do you deal with the problem of rhythm and sentence length and pauses?
Yeah, that's a very key issue. I really regret that I didn't hear Wang Gang do a reading before I started translating. I heard it only afterwards, and it conveyed a lot. But surely with proper punctuation, the rhythm and the breath should appear in the original text. You cannot translate word for word, phrase for phrase, sentence for sentence, or indeed paragraph for paragraph sometimes. So it's got to be English. So there are adjustments to be made. But try and capture something of the spirit, of the feeling that the original author writes about is as much as we can expect.
If I can just follow that, not just the feeling of the conveyed by the words, but the rhythm of the sentence is is part of the issue. I mean, you couldn't deal with James Joyce and say, well, without to use an extreme example, without dealing with the rhythm, because that's a key part of the meaning.
I think I was pretty lucky in that Wang Gang is a script writer, so he's accustomed to writing for television and movies, so his rhythm is easy to convey.
Just to get back to the idea of things trying to translate accurately, I know that you've worked with one of my old professors in university who felt that translation was more of an art than a science. Another one of my professors said there is no such thing as a word that can't be translated, and anyone who says an expression in Chinese is untranslatable is merely exposing their own ignorance in English. This probably goes to the heart of a lot of discussions in translation courses. Much like journalists talking around the bar, I'm sure this is the kind of conversation that goes around translating circles as well. But I mean, how do you feel? Where do you come down in that argument?
There are some terms that it might be very difficult to translate and will end up sounding so awkward that an editor will cut them. But so nothing is untranslatable, but would you want to read it?
This is a difficult question to ask. I think if you were to approach a work in translation or to translate a work, you could perhaps take one of two approaches in the sense of trying to explain cultural things to different people. One is that you don't pander at all to the fact that your readers don't know anything, don't have any experience in what you're writing, what you're, the author's writing about. And I can think of a number of translations of Chinese novels which do that. And the other approach would be to almost, if you like, rewrite the work for the audience. And I suppose either is justifiable depending on what you're trying to do. So my question is, which did you and your co-translator try to do? And how much of that was what you wanted and how much of that was what the publisher thought should be done?
Well, we pretty much went for the strategy of avoiding footnotes and avoiding lengthy explanations, but putting some explanations in here and there. I think that every piece of literature should challenge you a little bit. I'm thinking of Harry Kunzru's book, The Impressionist. I made a list of 72 words. I had no idea what he was on about. And he's an English writer. So I think it's only fair that there's a little bit of a challenge, but it's the balance of not making it too difficult and people lose interest, or making it too easy and people find it patronizing, or else, you know, footnotes that just trip you up and make you lose interest anyway. It probably depends on every different piece, but I would always try and go for putting in a little bit of an explanation rather than totally rewriting it, unless it really needed it.
I'm just curious how much Chinese history or knowledge should any translator know in order to sort of translate a sort of authentic a piece of translation for the English audience?
The more the better.
Someone who is equally fluent in either Chinese or English, what would be the easiest or the most challenging from English to Chinese or Chinese to English?
Well, I would never try to translate into Chinese. I feel quite comfortable translating into English. But
for someone who you think equally fluent in both languages, is there any reason why one would be more difficult than the other?
It really comes down to the sort of the cultural background issues and the, I mean, feeling comfortable about. I don't know too many people who feel comfortable about writing in Chinese, other than people who were brought up in a Chinese education system.
And that still gives me 1 minute, I think, Chris, for one last question. In advance of hearing Bao Pu speak on the prisoner of state, is there anything you might say about the difficulties of translating someone who's speaking of the modern political idiom?
Well, I've actually listened to the tapes that are on the New York Times, and it's very conversational. There is jargon there that I think, I don't know, I haven't read the English. I don't know how heavily they footnote it or explain it. But he Zhao Ziyang does speak, his natural speech is pretty heavily weighed down with jargon. But I don't think it's that big a challenge to turn into something that an educated person who keeps up with the Times to read.
All right. We should remember that when he speaks to us on June 4th. I think we've pretty much reached the end of this. I think we should have no more meetings.
Oh, well, of course, if you buy a book, I will grant you a personalized conversation while I...
Where can you buy those books, Marty?
Let me see.
Oh, just around the corner. My, how convenient.
Here we go, Marty. Thank you very much. It's long lost. He gets the tie at last.
Tie?
Oh, it's a t-shirt.
Okay, that's all right.